of that aperture, making sure that the air pressure doesn't blow the two modules apart. And he just takes some plastic, covers over this round hole that looked to me like it was 7 feet in diameter, and he strengthened the plastic by putting something that looked like duct tape over it. And you think you're going to hold back 14.7 pounds per square inch with that chunk of plastic? Not a chance in the world. The total number of pounds of force on that aperture would be many, many tons. Simple plastic with duct tape would never hold that. On top of that, along comes some high wind on Mars that blows the plastic in the opposite direction. Not a chance. So there was a little bit of inaccuracy in that area. I wonder if that struck you also, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the tech man.
Yeah, I had to imagine that this wasn't cellophane that he got out of supermarket, but you know, this is supposed to be, I'm thinking maybe some kind of space age plastic, you know, it's gonna be able to hold those PSI. And sure, yeah, I saw him tape it up with duct tape, and that's gonna help that's gonna help all this pressure. But you know, what I did like is he took the nylon strap, and he did with a ratcheting capability on it, and he put it around the whole circumference, and he cranked down on that. I mean, they were trying, you know. But if you read the book, naturally the book is loaded with technical stuff, and if they put all the technical stuff in that, that was in the book, you know, with the saboteur capability, the generating all this oxygen and how he went about doing it and how long it took me to recharge everything after he did damage to have, you know, they would chase people out of the movie theater the next Saturday. I recommend reading the book. It's pretty good. One thought I got, I mean, right at the beginning, by the way, anybody listening to this, you know, I'm going to try not to give away any ending, but these parts are pretty much known as some of the coming attractions. You see this. Did you get the problem with the antenna? With the first of all, it's high winds. Let me drop it. High winds. I would think nothing of standing out in the Martian atmosphere with 100 mile an hour winds going wouldn't bother me at all, because the pressure in the atmosphere is only 0.1% of the atmosphere that we have here, so you know, I'd be able to stand up and not fall over. So these high winds come along and just rip everything apart, including their antenna. You see the antenna take off, and that was the part that was stuck in him. In the book, they describe how he lives through this punctured spacesuit. They kind of glossed over that. Did you get the understand how that happened, how he survived that thing?
Yeah, not only did the antenna puncture his spacesuit and puncture his stomach, and it looked to me like it went in a good inch and a half in his stomach, and then he goes through a self-operation procedure when he goes back into his habitat to remove the piece that was embedded in his stomach, then disinfect it and put bandages over it. But how in the world the antenna penetrated the spacesuit without creating a great big leak? And later on in the movie, he intentionally creates a leak in a spacesuit in order to create propulsion. A science fiction that's kind of nice. If you really study the way a portable life support system on a backpack of a spacesuit, the way that works, you'd think you're going to use that very valuable oxygen in that backpack in order to create thrust the way he did and still have enough oxygen left over. Boy, there's some serious problems on that one. What wasn't made clear to me is why the puncture of the spacesuit and his stomach, why that didn't create a leakage of the air in the spacesuit that would create a problem. It did bring him down to a dangerous level of oxygen, and his alarm system in the suit told him that. But, by the way, later on when he damages the faceplate on a spacesuit, he again puts some duct tape over it, and that holds back the pressure. not likely. Affect you, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
Okay, very good. When that antenna took off, the first thing I said to myself, boy, Dick would love this freaking antenna flying through the air like that. The book describes it better. They glossed over it, but the antenna goes through the suit, and the plasma, whatever's in your blood, a little moisture in your body, that instantly freezes over. You got to understand, it's like, minus 50 degrees or something outside, and it instantly freezes. There's this freezing around the penetration of the antenna through the suit that creates a seal, because he's not moving. He's knocked out, so he's not moving, and it just creates, you know, it's like an instant plug. So yeah, the second it happened, the pressure drops in the suit, the alarms go off, but then because of this temporary sealing due to the cold weather around that injury, on the suit, that by doing that, then whatever pressure's in his tank comes back up again, and it actually shut the alarms off. But there you go, Dick. That's the beginning.
Yeah, Mars does get winds that go to numbers like 250 miles an hour. NASA has measured those. High velocity, but very little air pressure. Less than a tenth. I think it's 0.07, I think it is, of atmospheric pressure of Earth. So when you get a very low density atmosphere moving very fast, yes, it's going to create a dust storm, but would it take massive objects like that and throw them around? I think not. Also, when he put that great big round chunk of plastic where around the perimeter, yes, he's tightening it up with a nylon, one of those ratcheting type things. I made a rough guess that portal was 6 or 7 feet in diameter, and at 14.7, at 14.7 pounds per square inch, that would be a total pressure of 83,000 on that chunk of plastic. I'm having trouble believing that the plastic could sustain that pull. I think I do like the idea of the book indicating that the plasma of his blood filling up the hole and the cold temperatures could seal the hole to some degree. I can sort of accept that, although the amount of sealing that's required to really hold back air pressure, it can easily find a way out. By the way, the large diameter objects under air pressure develop extremely strong skin temperature by the so-called Laplace effect. This is the reason why an aneurysm, when you get a ballooning of a blood vessel, the aneurysm that forms can become very dangerous very fast because of the Laplace effect, the Laplace equation. That's the reason why a skinny diameter tire on an English bicycle's got to be inflated to 70 pounds. A fat diameter tire of an American bicycle only gets inflated to 28 pounds. And a much fatter tire on an automobile with 1,000 pounds of weight on that tire, again, only gets inflated to 28 pounds. That's this peculiar characteristic of skin temperature versus diameter of something that's holding back air pressure. So that portal that he covered up with plastic, with strips of, even if it's metalized duct tape, I don't think that could hold back 83,000 pounds, 40 tons. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RAW. Quick note, Dick. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I don't know if Eric's still listening. It seems that the Echolink is tied up in the conference mode. Rich may have a comment in there. I can't really tell.
KE2EJ, are you available? K2RAW in the tech net.
I think you called me. Hello, Dick.
Yeah, John, please repeat that message. KC2WGB.
Eric, it seems that VL is stuck in a conference mode. I don't know if it was switched over there or what happened. You might want to take a look at that if you get a chance.
No problem. Give me a minute. Can you do it, Jack?
Thank you.
HUC with a fast question. HUC, go right ahead, Steve. Hey, Dick, I haven't seen the movie yet, but and I'm just listening to it back and forth. But if a human's body was exposed to a pressure that much lower than atmosphere, wouldn't the boiling point of water start to... Wouldn't the boiling point of the water actually fall below the human body temperature? Wouldn't the water in his body actually start to boil as he's exposed to, you know, closer and closer to a vacuum? Just something that, you know, didn't quite make sense to me. KD2HUC.
Yeah, turns out Paul read the book, so he's going to give me a better information. My understanding of what happened in the movie is that Matt Damon is in his spacesuit. The whole spacesuit is properly pressurized. The majority of his body is under normal air pressure. This whip antenna, at high velocity, gets poked into his stomach, creates a very small hole in the spacesuit, a very small hole in him. And so the portion of his body hits up against the shaft of the antenna and up against the hole in the spacesuit. That little portion of his body and the blood that flowed at that point were led to believe that it came out, bubbled, froze, coagulated, and so a small amount of his body, of his blood, is surrounding the shaft of the antenna that has penetrated the suit, and the blood, by coagulation and freezing, sealed up that hole. It's a lucky coincidence, not impossible from my point of view. The rest of the spacesuit was being pressurized. The rest of his body was under normal pressure. I think it's possible. Back to you, Steve. K2LIW.
Okay. That makes a little more sense. Who knew? You know, you cut your finger, you can use it in lieu of thread tape, right? Make nicely tight joints. 82HUC, back to the net.
Pick up UPS.
You got it, Rich.
Hi, thanks, John and Dick. I have read the book. I've not seen the movie yet, but like Paul said, the book goes into a lot more detail, and in the book, it's not duct tape and a piece of plastic. It's this type of epoxy that kind of comes out, I guess, like toothpaste. And it hardens up pretty quick after you eject it from its container. And that's what he was using to seal different parts, like when he had holes and things. And the big patch that he used to cover that big opening was a type of like Kevlar-reinforced canvas. And the book does go into detail and describe it, and they make it very feasible. I mean, I know they can't do that all in the movie, but they do go into depth about just what that fabric is. And I could understand how, if they could be made, it would probably work that way, but it's not plastic and duct tape in the book.
Okay, that makes it a lot more feasible, a lot more tolerable, possible. However, with the air pressure inside of the habitat pressing against this Kevlar-reinforced canvas material, that look like plastic sheeting, and he's got a whole bunch of layers of, in this great big X-like pattern, he's got layers of what looks like duct tape, but maybe it's metallized duct tape across it, acting as a reinforcement. My calculation is 82 tons of air pressure is pressing against that material, and the Mars wind comes along and blows the material completely, instead of it being puffed outward, it was puffed inward, because of the Mars wind. That, I think, is very unlikely. I can't believe the Mars wind made 83,000 pounds of force, if you know what I mean. But the way he grew food, the way he created water, very difficult, but remotely possible. And an awful lot of things had to go just right for him to survive this mission. And when you look back at one other thing that's
bothered me a little bit. Let me drop it. In the early Gemini missions of NASA, did attempt a number of separate vehicles launched and linking up in space because they had already decided they're going to do lunar orbit rendezvous. In other words, it's not going to be one single rocket landing on the moon. It's going to be various pieces of a rocket going down and coming back and linking up. So relinking in space was very important. And a couple of the early Gemini missions attempted to do link up and did not succeed. Along came a guy called Buzz Aldrin. Buzz Aldrin, in his doctoral thesis at MIT, studied the problem of doing orbital linking. I mean, you think that all you've got to do is make a minor rocket burn, and now you're at a slightly higher altitude of orbit. Well, period orbit and radius of orbit is a function of radius cube equals period squared. In other words, the actual change in velocity versus change in altitude is an exponential function to the 3/2 power. Not at all simple. In order to link up with something, the two of you have to be in the exact same plane of orbit, coplanar orbit. The two of you have to have the exact same apogee and perigee. You've got to be in the right place at the right time, at the right orbital altitude, velocity, and at the right instant of time. To do a linking, you're doing a whole, you're solving 3 or 4 equations and 3 or 4 unknowns, if you know what I mean. Nowhere near as simple as you think. And in the movie, he just simply blasts off from the Earth, from the surface of Mars, and they link up in one very simple maneuver. They didn't go through all of the details of what's really required.
Repeater, time out.
I wonder if that part was more covered in the book, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yes, it was. And just like Rich said, you know, that's why I was looking at this plastic as some kind of space age type of thing. It's a movie, and people get duct tape. You know, I would imagine they said, let's just use duct tape. Making up all the oxygen. They kind of spent a lot of time on how much water he would need and how he was going to obtain that, and why he needed the hydrogen fuel from the landing part of the spacecraft that was still there, and how he utilized it. They got into the Pathfinder, bringing the Pathfinder back. Well, and in the book, you can read this for hours about how he did this in the movie. It looked like, stand by. It looked like it was 1, 2, 3, like he just went out there and got that Pathfinder and kind of brought it back. The multiple trips that he went and how he spent so much time in the rover. And eventually does get to the Pathfinder. And just the idea of putting this thing on the roof of the rover, they explain it in detail. I mean, it's a heavy object, even so everything weighs 0.38 of what it weighs here on Earth. It was still a heavy object. He had to build a ramp of sand and everything to get this thing on top of the rover. They're not going to spend all this time in the movie on that. I don't think that would interest the public. But it interests me. It was very well done in the book on how he gets this thing back. I like the ASCII system that they used. It would take forever to do what he was doing. It beat out putting all your alphabet all the way around in a circumference. Like they said, the camera wouldn't be able to make all those degree turns. So they got a lot of things pretty right. I'm dropping. Spent a lot of time in the book, using the ASCII system, and a lot of time explaining how they got this code and everything put into the rover. I mean, that just didn't happen in one quick sweep. This took a month or two before they were able to do this. In the book. So you're compressing a 2-hour and 20-minute movie from a a book, if you read it, take your time reading it, it could take you a long time. It took me probably about a month on and off reading that book. Doug, over to you. We can talk about Rendezvous, and I mean, they had to do it that way. They had to have that Chinese thing link up, and they had to have him link up because he wasn't going into orbit. It was a direct shot right to the spacecraft. That's why they had to do it like that.
A direct shot to the spacecraft sounds like an easy thing to do. If you went straight from the ground, straight up to the spacecraft, which was in Mars orbit, I'm going to pick a number, is 10,000 miles an hour, and you go straight up to it, and there's a huge velocity difference between the two. He's got to go into an orbit that is the same plane of orbit, the same velocity, the same apogee, the same perigee. Everything's got to be just right.
Dick, the Hermes wasn't in orbit. It wasn't in orbit.
It was flying by Mars. It was about to do a gravity figure eight loop around Mars. Isn't that true? Go ahead.
That's true. You got that. That's true.
That's equivalent to being in a figure eight is really a high velocity orbit. And so you can't go straight up to it. You've got to join that exact same orbit, if you know what I mean, in order to be in the right place at the right time at the right velocity. So they crossed over that quite a bit. Linking up is nowhere near as easy. As I said, it took a guy with a doctorate degree in the subject as his doctoral thesis. That's what Buzz Aldrin had done in order to make that a successful operation on the Gemini. And boy, did he need that on Apollo 11. Because when they came back up from the moon, they didn't link up with the command service module. There ain't no coming home with the lunar module, if you know what I mean. Nowhere near enough supplies on board. And so they didn't really cover where all of the oxygen is coming from. I mean, yes, he's burning hydrazine in order to make water. He's supplying oxygen to do that. And by the way, where's all the carbon dioxide coming from? I guess the carbon dioxide to run the plants is coming from the exhale of his body. There's sort of the possibility there. Now,
the atmosphere is loaded with carbon dioxide.
Okay, that's a good one. Mars does have carbon dioxide. Now, in order to grow plants, you don't need sunlight. I mean, he didn't really have a hothouse there. He was growing the plants on the artificial lighting. And the plants need ultraviolet light to really do an efficient job of photosynthesis. Are you going to believe that the lights that were in the habitat are giving off ultraviolet light? Well, if those lights were designed for human exposure, we intentionally design lights to have low ultraviolet output because that creates damage to human beings. So you got a bit of a conflict of those lights being efficient to grow those potatoes that he was growing. Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
Well, because he was the botanist. I'm going to have to take them on their word on that one. He was the botanist, and he knew how to do this thing. You got to understand that. That's why he was so good at growing all this stuff, because, you know, you sent all kinds of people up and different experts for different things. Well, that was his main thing. But he knew how to do this thing with the exact, you know, he broke everything down. And again, in the book, you should see how much time they spend on this, figuring out how he's going to grow this thing.
John, I think you said that you saw the movie this weekend also. Tell us your early impressions of the movie called The Martian with Matt Damon. He plays a good part. My family thinks the movie is going to get an Academy Award. KC2WGB, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
KC2WGB. No, Dick, I haven't seen it yet. I'd like to, but haven't had the opportunity.
I do recommend you see it. From my point of view, it was well done. Paul knows, I guarantee they spent lots of megabucks on special effects and creating these props. Lots and lots of details there. And I'm nitpicking. I'm choosing individual items the average person doesn't worry about. But to maintain a human being in space, is a hell of a lot more difficult than first meets the eye. I mean, here he is in these spacesuits, days on end, and we don't even worry about how is he disposing of waste products. As I think I've told you guys, anybody who does a space walk in a space suit is really wearing a very large absorbent diaper. And when you're in that diaper for 8 hours at a time, what do you do to avoid diaper rash? It's a real problem. No two ways about it. We gloss over all of those details. Let me ask you this question, Paul. During one of those portions of the movie, he digs up the radioactive thermal electric generator, and he suddenly uses it to get a lot of power to move his rover. Then at the end, when he's got to take a very long trip, he's taking this long trip days at a time, where during the day he puts out the solar panels to charge the batteries, and at nighttime he moves. And why wasn't he using the radioactive thermal generator at that time? Did it somehow get consumed or fail? Over to you, Paul. K2LIW.
RTG, and it's basically the same as the one that's on Curiosity, and one that's on Cassini. It's putting out 103 watts of electricity, but it's putting out 1,200 watts of heat. So that was his heater. That was the main thing that he was using it for. And he knew he wasn't going to get enough draw to run the recharge the rovers. So he had to bring all these solar panels with him, and he had disconnected them from the main hab. And that's another thing. Rich is probably laughing driving his truck, but the way they describe on how he bought these panels on top of the rover and how he attached them in extreme detail to get them to one place to another. So the panels were giving him the real recharge power that he needed for the batteries. But I want to go to the Hermes spacecraft. We need a big spacecraft to go to Mars, just like that one. And that one had the spinning part to create gravity. And that's really a takeoff from one of NASA's original proposals called the Nautilus. Nautilus system had a spinning setup like that to create some kind of a small amount of gravity, but enough, better than nothing, for a trip to Mars. Back to you, Dick.
As I remember it, in the original movie 2001 A Space Odyssey, the spacecraft, the space station was a very large rotating wheel making artificial gravity. I accept that. In this particular movie, there was a rotating wheel and a stationary hub. That means there's a rotary joint, a very large rotary joint, that people are able to travel through inside the spacecraft. Tell me about that rotary joint that's holding back air pressure. You have this huge rotary joint under constant air pressure. That's an extremely difficult design. If you rotate the whole aircraft, the whole spacecraft, I accept that. But to have portions of it stationary and portions of it rotating with that perfect air sealed rotary joint. I'm not convinced that you can make a design that'll do that, that'll survive more than a day. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's a takeoff from not a sealed system, but, you know, as close to it as you can get. The International Space Station has two big rotary joints on the truss segments going out. Truss 3 and 4. I think we call it 3 and 4. Am I right? 3, 4, 5, 6. One of them. There's one on the port side, one on the starboard side. And the rotary joint is as big as they say is a Volkswagen, you know. Alright, so we're not going through it. It's not sealed. But this is 20 years down the road, and they know how to do it better. You have to make, jump to some kind of a conclusion there. That's how it would be a tough engineering feat to do what you're doing. That's probably how to get around it. Again, to create that kind of gravity is good. I know I'm going to time it out.
come in, Dick?
Second, before I lose that thought. Carl Sagan wrote about this wheel setup a long time ago, and there is some kind of an effect. The big wheel, like you have on 2001, yeah, you'd be able to walk around, and that would be okay, but the smaller the wheel is, or the shorter the radius is of these wheels, as you're trying to walk, creating an effect because your head and your feet want to, you know, move it at a different rate, and there's a name for it, I forget. You might remember what it's called. It's some kind of a, I'm going to call it not a dizzying effect, but just it won't work out. You can lay down and go around and around, but there's no way you can walk for an extended period of time. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the fact that you're rotating at a fast rate is a little bit similar to what happens when a child does this game where he rotates his body very rapidly by moving his feet, and you spin around, and pretty soon your vestibular system, the portion of the semicircular canals in the hearing system that tell you which way is up, gets pretty confused. And so you're going to run into some of that effect if that wheel is not very large in diameter. I agree with you. The head and your feet are moving at a different circumferential velocity. John had a question. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, if you had a wheel with spokes, as you see in that sign they had in 2001, if the center hub was fixed and a contiguous structure of the entire wheel, and inside of that you could have a rotating chamber, that would pose no problem at all?
I like that. So if you want to have a non-rotating chamber, you create an inner device where it doesn't have a rotary joint trying to hold back air pressure. The only place I know of where there's a rotary joint holding back air pressure is the shaft coming out of the air conditioning pump, air conditioning compressor that we have on every one of our automobiles. That's an extremely precise joint that when the air conditioner is running, when the compressor is running, compressor oil is continuously being splashed up onto that precision joint. If you didn't run your air conditioner for a solid year, summer and winter, and that oil from that rotary joint dries out, the Freon leaks out pretty fast. So you've got to periodically run that compressor, even in the wintertime. Turn it on once in a while to make sure you're splashing oil up on it, on that bearing, so as not to lose the Freon. But that bearing on the compressor of an automobile is, what, 3/4 of an inch in diameter. Try to make something 6 feet in diameter as an air-pressurized rotary joint that people could fly through on the inside of the spacecraft. Wow. That's a design I don't think is doable. Yes, the huge rotary joint you got from the solar panels, let me drop this. On the International Space Station, allow the solar panels to keep it aimed at the sun, even though the spacecraft keeps its orientation with the references to the Earth's surface below them. And so that rotary joint doesn't have to hold back air pressure, doesn't have to be as large in diameter the person can swim through it. And even that rotary joint has given some problems. Isn't that true, Paul? Maybe it's the slip rings of that rotary joint that are taking those kilowatts, many kilowatts. And you've told us, and repeat that, roughly how many kilowatts are being generated by those, I think we've got 16 panels, 16 great big solar panels on the International Space Station. WS2N, K2RIW.
KC2FYJ, comment.
I think it's a total around a little over 200, around 200. Yeah, they did spacewalks, and I hear another comment, so, well, they fixed it. They didn't make a long story short. They found a way to actually, let's call it, grease it, and it's only on the one side, the port side. The starboard side was good. Thank you.
KC2FYJ, K2LAW, go ahead, I think it's Harry.
Good evening, Dick. Yes, it is Harry. I just wanted to remind you that they probably are not pressurizing to 14.7 pounds per square inch, but are at something much less than that, and therefore the pressure on that bearing to keep the air in would not be as great as it might be if you were using full Earth surface pressure.
The astronauts are willing to tolerate very low air pressure. I think they go down to 5 pounds per square inch of nearly pure oxygen when they're inside of the space suit. But you suffer some disadvantages when you do that. Your eyes dry out in a funny way. There are certain things that are the long exposure at low air pressure and high oxygen content. It doesn't completely compensate. It is my belief that the International Space Station flies at 14.7 pounds per square inch of normal air with a 21% oxygen. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
That's true, and it's the same mixture of nitrogen and oxygen that we have here. The only difference from the space station is, of course, they're missing the couple of percent, whatever it is, of argon and everything else. So, you know, they're just... But yes, they duplicated, and they did it on a shuttle. The only time the shuttle went down to 10 pounds was when they were getting ready for a spacewalk. They would load the whole thing down to 10 pounds, even so they had an airlock there. That was just to get them in shape, getting ready not to get the bends. It helped before they would, you know, go into the airlock. But now and the same with the Mir. Mir was 14.72. I would imagine the Hermes, the one going to Mars, you know, in a Martian, is going to be the same thing. They'll want to keep that at 14.7. I don't think there would be any reason to change that back here.
Because there are some definite disadvantages of running a human being at low air pressure, even though you think you're compensating by making the oxygen a much higher percentage. The main reason why they do that in the spacesuit is because the best design they've come up with so far on your elbows and shoulder and knee joints, the joints of the spacesuit, the best design they've come up with so far has to fight air pressure. The air pressure wants those joints to be out straight, and you're trying to bend those joints. And when you bend the joints, you're changing the volume of the suit, and the air pressure is resisting that volumetric change. You talk to an astronaut that's done a long spacewalk. Let me drop it. And he's quite tired because of all of the muscle power he has had to exert in order to bend those particular joints. When you're running at 5 pounds per square inch, if you ran the spacesuit at 15 pounds per square inch, there would be three times the extra force required on all of those joints. And if you developed a leak somewhere, the leak would happen much more rapidly. The gloves would inflate in a funny way and so on. So there's a huge disadvantage of running the spacesuit at a low air pressure as far as the human being is concerned. But there's a high advantage as far as the actual movement of the joints of the suit itself. You see what I'm saying on that one, Harry? KC2FYJ, K2LIW.
Understood, and I stand corrected on the pressure inside the station and such. I was under the impression that they were around 10, but I will bow to greater knowledge.
Now, you can do things like that with human beings for short periods of time, but extended living, I mean, we are, you could say by evolution or by him, we are carefully designed for this particular environment we live in. Boy, do we take, we completely forget about all the things that are going on every day. The huge number of cubic meters of air that's continuously going into your body and being exhaled. Because we've got this great atmosphere and lots of it, we ignore that. When you've got to artificially create that atmosphere on board, and you've got to supply that oxygen and that air pressure, that's a consumable. Put a man in space for a year. You have to supply, in order to keep him alive, consumable air, water, and fuel that has the volume of your house and the mass of your house. That's what's required to sustain one human being for 1 year if you're not doing recycling. And the word recycling sounds real good on paper. You try to take every single... Let me drop. You take every single molecule of solid, liquid, and gas that comes out of a human being and recycle it, making it back into potable air, water, and food. Oh boy, that's a hell of a lot more difficult than first meets the eye. When you're alive and you're metabolizing, you're continuously metabolizing food, water, air, at the rate of 130 watts, 24/7. You're continuously dissipating 130 watts of heat because of the metabolism that's going on in your body. That's a lot of energy. I mean, each watt is a joule for 1 second. So 130 joules per second are flowing into and out of your body by way of the air, food, and water that you're consuming to maintain that metabolism. That's if you're just sitting still in the theater seat. And if you're really doing labor, those numbers go up to 2 or 3 times that number. That energy's got to come from somewhere. And so some of these details, I wonder how much the book went into the energy a human being consumes and how it was being supplied on this Mars mission. Did the book go into very much of that, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Oh yeah, and they would talk about what one human would need, compare it to the crew of six that was originally there, and you know what he has left over, and they would talk about what he's going to have to produce, and they did show that to some degree in the movie, which was pretty good. I mean, you know, I would say 80, it's got to be 80 or 90% of what was in the book is in the movie, including the old music. All music was great, and that was true in the book as well. So they copied that. My wife liked it, and that's saying a lot because, you know, another space movie. She thought it was very good. I think she agrees with the Oscar for that movie. Back to you, Dick.
Near the end of the movie, my wife got emotional, so she connected with it. So they did a good job along those lines. One other thing that bothered me a little bit, Paul, and that is, you and I, as ham radio operators, in the early days, we used to dream about amateur radio television, and you rapidly discover that the degree of difficulty of sending a picture, the amount of bandwidth it takes, the amount of signal-to-noise ratio it takes, is at least 1,000 times more difficult than sending audio. So, in this particular movie, he gets the Sojourner, I guess it is, the Mars rover. He gets his Mars spacecraft, and he turns it back on, powers it up, and sends pictures. But to send audio is 1,000 times easier than sending pictures. So, to go through that hexadecimal jazz, as opposed to just finding some way of coupling the audio, it could have been done a lot easier. The quickest way to communicate with a human being is with speech. Faster than printing, typing, sending pictures. To send information back and forth, they really needed audio. And so, to find a way of buggering that up to send audio, I think should have been considered. Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
He's a botanist, not an electronic person, KQFYJ. And, you know, no microphone left. You know, whatever was there was gone, destroyed. In the time before, you know, when the book was made, there weren't that many satellites going around Mars. I don't think the guy envisioned all the capabilities with UHF, you know, all he would have needed was a UHF transceiver. He could have talked to Odyssey or Mars Global Surveyor or Mars Express, for that matter, also going around Mars, and to get a message back. But they didn't see it that way. There was no audio left. How am I going to do it? I'll do it with pictures. And that's how they did it, with pictures. So now this would take a long time. And in a book, it did take a long time to move the camera each time they needed to transmit a message for ASCII. In the book, this guy, it seemed like he was there for forever before the next big scene would happen. In the movie, it was, 1, 2, 3. So I can think of a lot of things here. That was called Pathfinder, by the way, that he dug up. Pathfinder brought the Sojourner down in 1997. Pathfinder opened up, Sojourner drove away, and Pathfinder was the main, receiving and transmitting vehicle. With a camera and everything on board. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think it was Roger that gave us a set of words, and that Matt Damon in the movie is a botanist, not an electronic engineer. So therefore, to make that change to transmit audio instead of video would have required a significant amount of change to the Sojourner or the Pathfinder hardware. Another thing, every piece of electronics we own has different connectors for the microphone and B+ input and whatever. I mean, he's taking this cable from the Habitat, and it just happened to have the right connector so he could plug it into Pathfinder and power up Pathfinder. Did that bother you at all, Paul? The connector just happened to be compatible. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I read it on, I guess it was either a NASA site or a space.com site, that the connector pretty much doesn't exist on Pathfinder to do that. There was no need to it. And then they did say that there was some other kind of external connector. Maybe he could have used that, for testing and powering things up on Earth. So they did get around that one, but the LED, that lights that lit up, they say there's none on that. Pathfinder, the old lights came on. Oh, good, it's working. Back in there.
If you decide to put solar panels on your house so that you become a little bit closer to being energy independent for electrical power, you soon discover that there's a very careful design that goes in between the output voltage current capability versus various amounts of sunlight. It goes into a fancy chunk of electronics that does all the regulating and eventually creates 60-cycle, 120-volt AC power that you either can run your appliances or pack or pump back into a Con Ed or LIPA or Loco, if you know what I mean. So there's a careful design marriage required between a given number of solar panels and the converting electronics. You don't just simply take solar panels and connect them directly to batteries to be charged. That's an extremely inefficient technique. You could easily be overvoltaging your batteries or underusing the solar panels. The electronics that goes in between the two has to recognize the fact that, let me drop, for each amount of solar illumination you're getting right now, there's an ideal load resistor that you put on those solar panels in order to maximize the energy output at this instant. And you have to change the magnitude of the load resistor equivalent in your electronics as you increase or decrease the amount of sunlight into the solar cells. Solar cells have got this very complicated, slightly nonlinear characteristic. I mean, you look at the voltage coming out of solar cells, and you start loading it down. It's a little bit like the discharge curve you get from a Nikon battery. In other words, the curve stays fairly flat, and all of a sudden it takes a nosedive. As you draw a little bit more current, all of a sudden the voltage drops to something very low. So to operate at that upper right-hand knee, where you get maximum energy output, takes a careful adjustment of the apparent loading of your electronics versus the amount of solar illumination. He needed that in order to get maximum charge rate of his batteries for the number of solar panels he had. And it had to be designed for a specific number of solar panels. I'll bet you the book didn't go into those details, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
No, it didn't. It talked about panels, but mainly the weight of them and how to move them around. Apparently they were operational at the HAB, so I guess he just duplicated what they had at the HAB. But if you were going to put this on the house, I haven't looked that much into putting them on my house. I haven't even thought about that seriously. I probably will never do that. But I pay attention to when a show was on, Channel 13 had this whole house on, and I think the guy had like 20 panels on the roof. And they showed that, you know, they used to hook them up in series, and there was a little shade on one side of the roof that would knock it down, and that would knock down the drawer of basically all the panels at one time. And they showed that what this system had was individual inverters to every panel, and so, you know, each one was running wires to a cable that was essentially AC, and they'd run it down to the panel, and even if one panel quit or whatever, everything was tied in parallel. It wouldn't matter. Back to you, Dick.
The one part I didn't understand is that as he's about to take this very long trip at the end, they advise that he use a whole bunch of drilled holes to make this great big circular hole in the top of his vehicle he's going to travel in. First of all, why did he make that hole in the top of the vehicle? Second of all, once he does that, he no longer has the ability to pressurize that vehicle. That means from then on, he has to live in that spacesuit. To live in the spacesuit for as long as 7 or 8 hours, a story Musgrove did, is heroic. To live for weeks on end in a spacesuit that you can't climb out of and you can't clean the diaper. Do I have to go into any more details? Why did they drill that hole, and how did he survive the ability to no longer be able to pressurize that vehicle so he can climb out of the spacesuit? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah. I forgot. I'm going to look that up in the book because I know that was a big, important part, even in the book. I got a kick out of it. I mean, they went into detail about drilling these holes and, you know, one right after the other, and like he did. And he needed that globe on top of him. And I cannot remember the reason for it. But they didn't explain it. They didn't explain it in the movie, and I forgot why they did it. And that was months and months, I don't know, 4 or 5 months or something to get from one location to the other, some 1,400 kilometers or something. That wasn't weeks, that was months, many, many months before he got to that launching site. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, and each day, and hopefully this is during the Mars summer, because if this occurred during the Mars winter where he is in the northern hemisphere, so to speak, he would be in really bad shape. So each day he's setting out the solar panels to charge the batteries during the day, and sleeping under the vehicle during the day, and then traveling at night. Well, they didn't go into very much detail as to how cold Mars really gets at nighttime. It gets extremely cold. To travel at that many thousands of kilometers in all the vehicles, the solar panels, and the motors and the batteries, and nothing goes bad on that trip. You couldn't possibly carry enough spare parts to maintain electronics and the mechanics to do that. And you'd have to be so careful on the trip that you take. If you go into a sinkhole, if you go into a divot, if you go into when a meteor hits the planet and gives you a big depression, and so all of a sudden they can't think of the name of the thing. To avoid all the possible hazards while traveling that number of miles, and all the electronics and all the mechanics hangs in there. Not very likely. Over to you on that one, Paul. Did the book go into that? K2RIW?
They did talk about the reliability of these rovers, how good they were, and how many thousands and thousands of hours tested everything, the motors, the batteries, the wheels. These were supposed to be super reliable things, and he felt confident that he could make a trip like that. But you're right, you know, I mean even the wheels on the Curiosity are wearing out. It's only gone like, 10 miles or something, not even 6 miles. So, you know, again, you got to understand this book was written before the SLS program, before the Space Launch System. You'll notice they called it the Ares. Everything was Ares 3, Ares 4, Ares 5. Ares was an existing system that has been done away with. They launched one Ares rocket in real life, and then that was it. They killed that whole program. In fact, they killed the whole Constellation program. Ares was going to be the new rocket that was first going to bring us back to the moon and then on to Mars. So, got to remember this thing was written quite a few years ago. And if you notice at the end, did you see the rocket going up, Dick? You know what rocket that was. That was supposed to be Ares 6. Did you see the launch?
Sure did, and I wasn't paying attention to the specifics. You're going to tell me about that. I should know, and I don't know, who is the author of the book. Was it somebody famous that we know? You recognize the configuration of the launch vehicle, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it looked nothing like the original Ares was going to look like. And it sure didn't look like the SLS system, but it was the Delta IV Heavy, where you take three Delta IVs and bolt them together. And on top of that was the Orion spacecraft that was test launched last December 2014, almost a year ago. The one that went up 3,600 miles and then returned to Earth at 20,000 miles per hour to test the heat shield and all the other stuff that's on board the future Orion spacecraft. So that was interesting. There was something else you asked me, but I forgot. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, who is the author of the book, Paul?
Is it Weir? W-E-I-R? I could go over and get it, but you'll see. That, I mean, this guy's not, you know. You know, imagine writing a book and all of a sudden it becomes a big hit. It's one of those deals. You know, I think it's his first shot at doing something like this. So, you know. It's like rolling seven on the first hand, you know, first roll of the dice, putting all the money down in one bet.
It does seem to be rather well thought out. In other words, a lot of details are covered in the book and the movie. And yes, I'm nitpicking on the things that don't quite fit reality as I see it. The number of students right now, or other people who have volunteered for these future Mars one-way missions, when they see this movie, they're going to be enthralled. They're going to say, hey, that's a glamorous frontier. I want to go there. They're forgetting a lot of the details. The real temperatures at nighttime on Mars are way beyond brutal, way beyond life-threatening. And when you talked earlier about a mission to the South Pole of the Moon, where, yes, in those craters, there's believed to be frozen water. Let me drop. And so, the good news is you don't have to put up with the extremely high temperatures that you get at the lunar equator at high noon. At high noon, they last for 57 hours, as opposed to on Earth, high noon lasts for 2 hours. So 57 hours of high noon at the equator on the moon, you get numbers like 160 degrees centigrade. Way beyond life-threatening. I don't know if you could come up with enough air conditioning that allows you to even survive that environment. What are you going to use as the heat sink? You don't have air or water to dump the heat into. What are you going to dump it into? You can say, well, I'm just going to radiate into space. It sounds easy. It's not. So when you locate yourself at the South Pole of the moon, you're in an extremely dark, cold environment. You're getting a little bit of sunlight always on the horizon. And you're putting up with numbers like minus 260 degrees centigrade. Wow. You better have one hell of a furnace that can make heat. You better have extremely good insulation. And even though you can pick up some ice that's